still for some moments, though without looking directly at Owen.
"Do you think I don't know where you've been?" Owen said. "She pretends not to understand anything," he added to Paris. "Migo call Mandingo priest man," he said loudly. "He catch a thief tomorrow. You hear that?"
The woman glanced indifferently at him, then turned and walked slowly out of the room.
"She has been plotting with her relatives," Owen said. "But I've given her something to think about now. Serve yourself, sir. Let us not stand on ceremony."
Paris took to boiled fowl and rice and a sauce of palm oil and chopped peppers. Small black flies had entered the room. He felt the occasional sting through his shirt. Glancing up, he found Owen's eyes on him in a wide, unsteady stare.
"The Mandingos have a fashion of finding things out," the factor said. "I did not believe it when I came here at first, but I've seen things with my own eyes. They follow the law of Mahomet, according to the Archon, and they learn it from the Moors of Barbary and elsewhere, and so fetches it down here by these wandering pilgrims. You may say it is not reasonable for a Christian man to believe they are able to perform anything above the common run, but I have seen them with nothing but a few feathers and a handful of sand find out the secrets of futurity in things that people have spoke of to no one. It is my belief they have the power of some evil spirit or familiar sent to them by the great enemy to draw these ignorant bullums to himself."
The rum he had drunk, the wavering light, his host's oddly disconnected speech had combined to confuse Paris. It seemed to him for a moment that the factor was referring to some powerful and malignant slave trader further in the interior.
"Who is that?" he said. "Further upriver, is he?"
"I'm talking about Satan." Owen looked gloomily before him. His mood was turning morose. He had eaten very little and now thrust his plate aside and reached again for the bottle.
"It is by Satan's help these ignorant wretches are so deceived," he said. "The bullum compose the local population, don't they? Is the woman, your housekeeper, is she a bullum?" "No, she belongs to the crew people. They're darker, aren't they? Yellow Henry and his band are bullum, I suppose. Well, he is a mulatto, of course, but..."
"You were acquainted with Henry Cook, then?"
"It was he who came with our first slaves."
"He'll never come with another." Owen clapped white, slender hands at a fly, looking afterwards with a sort of hallucinated intensity for traces on his palms.
"Why? What do you mean?"
But the factor had reverted to his former gloomy staring and made no reply. He remained silent for some considerable time, with his head sunk on his chest. Paris was beginning to think he had gone to sleep when he spoke again, in the blurred and dogged fashion of a man contending with his own obscured senses to reach to the heart of truth.
"No," he said. "For all religion, these bullums have only the Poraman."
"Who is he?"
"There is a secret mystery that these people have kept for many ages, or for all we know, since their first foundation. It goes by the name of Pora, or Poramen. These men are marked in their infancy by the priests with three or four rows of small dents upon their backs and shoulders. Anyone that has not these marks they look on is of no account. There is one among the rest who personates the devil, or Pora. He hides himself in some convenient place within call, and upon his priests shouting, he in the bush answers it with a terrible screech. Wherever the women or white men or any that is not Pora hear it, they fly immediately to their houses and shut all the windows and doors. Any caught outside will be torn to pieces."
Owen raised his head and fixed the surgeon with a sombre regard.
"I have heard them," he said. "I have heard the screams. Sounds carry in this place. The Pora hasn't come this far yet, though."
He attempted a derisive expression, but there was no change in his eyes.
"It is all nonsense, anyway. No one but a savage could believe in it. They come into town afterwards, this mock devil with his gang about him, and he speaks through a reed, and he tells on what account he comes and demands liquor and victuals. Then he goes away with singing and dancing, and all is quiet again. 'Tis all faking. Anyone with the curiosity to peer out of their houses would see it was only a man dressed up.
They cannot surely lack for curiosity to that extent, Paris said. Either they are too terrified to look out, or, and this I think more probable, they accept the mummery for the sake of order, just as we do. You say these people are charlatans. Well, just look at England. She is a paradise for poorer men. The church and the learned professions and Parliament are full of them.
He hesitated here, with some feeling of compunction. Owen's eyes were mournful and moist. He had wanted only to confide his solitude, his fears of the dark, but the surgeon was a little drunk, and the memory of his shame was hot in his mind, and his old vice of prideful assertiveness had him now in its grip.
"The system works better here," he said. "It has great consequence for the peace of the country. In Liverpool, not long before I left, a gang of seamen started to break up a brothel where one of them had been robbed. Others joined in. The watch was powerless to do anything. In the end, they had to call in a regiment of militia and read the riot act. Two seamen and a passerby were killed outright, and one of the girls crippled for life before they could restore order."
Paris paused, smiling his bitter, lopsided smile. He was arrogant, with superior wisdom, and intensely dislikable at this moment.
"If it had happened here," he said, "just one screech from the bushes would have solved all. Are you comparing things at home to this benighted place? I see you're one of those who always think they know better."
Owen raised his head to look steadily at Paris. Anger had stiffened him, given clarity to his speech.
"You do not know better, sir. You do not know worse, even. You know nothing at all of the nature of life here along this pestilential river."
There was silence between them for a short while. Paris sat with shoulders bowed, his big knuckled hands thrust between his knees, as if for safe keeping. Then he looked squarely into the other man's face.
"You're right," he said, "and I'm sorry that I spoke as I did."
Rage to have the better of it, unwillingness to compromise, these were old failings in him, if failings they be. New, however, no older than Ruth's death, was the swift remorse that would come to him, a feeling like sorrow at having delivered a wound for the mere sake of argument. The kind of truth that can be asserted by argument had lost all glamour, all lustre for him, seeming no more now than another aspect of that ancient urge, much older than the desire for truth, to command attention, dominate one's fellows. The fuddled man before him was truth enough. He had belittled the nature of the factor's servitude. Owen needed to despise his surroundings in order to endure them. That a man engaged in this cruel trade still deserved not to be treated with cruelty seemed a mystery to Paris, rather than a truth, but it was one which contained a strong imperative for him.
"Why don't you get out?" he said gently. "Why don't you leave this place?"
"Get out?" Owen laughed on a rising note. "Where to? All my capital is sunk here. I cannot return a pauper. They do not welcome prodigal sons. No, I'm caught here, 7 degrees above the line, 3,000 miles from my native seat."
He laughed again briefly, and licked slowly and carefully round his mouth.
"I'm hoping for an upturn in trade," he said in low tones, "before the poorer man gets me. Eh, Mr. Paris?"
It was Paris's private view that fever and rum would find Owen first, but he was relieved to see the expression of weak jocularity that had come now to his host's face.
"I was something of a poorer man myself in England," he said, not knowing quite what he meant, wanting to keep Owen in this lighter mood.
In this he succeeded. The factor had come round full circle and was disposed to sodden laughter now. The notion of this rather gangling, crease-faced guest of his lurking and screeching was one he found very risible, and it was on this note of mirth and restored amity that the two men parted for the night, Owen unsteadily to his bedroom, where the crew woman had lain asleep some hours already, Paris to the small guest room at the end of the house, with its bunk bed and net canopy, and its own door onto the veranda. Here he lay for a long time, sleepless, in spite of the drink. Thinking of the diseased slave woman and the voracious mud-coloured crabs creeping up from the river, and of the extraordinary ramifications of this trade in human creatures. Fumbling in his mind for some grasp of the complex chain of transactions between the capture of a negro and the purchase of a new cravat by Erasmus Kemp, his cousin, or the giving of a supper party by his uncle, he thought he heard again that distant pattering sound of surf or drums. There were occasional cries of nightbirds. Sometime during the night, he thought he heard the mutter of voices and afterwards groans that might have been caused by love or nightmare. Finally, he fell into a troubled sleep, only to be brought awake again, not much after dawn, by the need to void his bladder. He dressed and passed out onto the veranda, and from there to the side of the house that was nearest to him. There was a chill in the air, but no breath of wind. A thin mist lay over the compound and the shrub beyond it. There were sleeping forms under brightly coloured blankets in the lean-to where the woman had sat winding her thread. Paris passed behind the house, avoided approaching too near the barracoon, which was silent and partly shrouded in mist, and urinated against the far side of a low shed near the edge of the clearing. In the immediate, mildly scalding pleasure of the discharge, he noticed nothing, but as he buttoned himself and prepared to return, he became aware of a smell of animal decomposition, cold, dank, quite unmistakable. It did not come, as he had thought at first, from within the forest, but from immediately before him, from inside the shed. He hesitated briefly, then advanced his face to peer through the splintered plank. In rapid review, in the seconds before recoil, he saw three naked bodies, blood-streaked and dreadfully staring, one bigger than the others, on its back, a big-featured face he knew, despite the blood-filled sockets where the eyes had been, a mounded belly the colour of dry clay, incongruously soft and smooth-looking, with a smear of red on it like a cattle brand. Flies had found them out, even thus early, he saw the gauzy glint of wings. One outflung hand had a thumb missing. He remembered the men who had held up their hands and grinned. As though reinforced by this recognition, the smell grew denser, sickening. Paris went back, as though pursued, across the clearing. He thought he heard a faint rattling from the barracoon. Glancing up, he saw two vultures, heads settled on necks, asleep on the ridgepole. Later, at breakfast, he said nothing of his discovery to Owen, who was sick-looking and uncommunicative this morning, though he produced coffee for his guest from a carefully hoarded store, for which Paris was profoundly grateful. The crew woman was nowhere to be seen. "Well," Paris said, as one of his oarsmen pushed barefoot against the mooring post and the canoe edged out towards midstream, "I hope your Mandingo priest will get to the bottom of things." It was the only hope he felt able to express for Owen. As the river began to curve away, he turned to look back. The factor was still there, diminutive and lonely, standing on the bankside, amidst the detritus of palm leaves and dead crabs, watching him out of sight. At the last moment, Owen took off his hat and waved it once. Then the canoe took the bend, and he was cancelled abruptly. The forested banks resumed their sway, concealing all traces. That scrape of human lodgment, focal point of wretchedness, the house, the compound, Owen with his longing for salad and polite manners, the shackled slaves and the stinking barracoon, no smallest hint of it remained. The river was the only reality here. The river was the link of trade. Slaves came down from the upper reaches, perhaps hundreds of miles. The river bore them down to its bellowing mouth, the terrible ordeal of the surf, the open sky, the waiting ships. Wherever on this coast that there were rivers, it would be the same. The rivers of Africa admitted the slavers to her vitals. The long, light canoe was making good speed. The oarsmen set up a rhythmic cry as they thrust on the poles, perhaps in warning of their approach, as the channel was winding and the craft in midstream. But the men who were rowing him were so like those he had seen in the barracoon, in colour and in general cast of feature, he was beginning to notice such things now, that this wild cry of theirs seemed irresistibly to Paris
like a cry of mourning for those in chains, who are too lost to mourn for themselves. Chapter 28. When Paris got down as far as Tucker's, he found the yawl ready to leave, with only Thurso waited for. The slaves lay bound amidships, crowded promiscuously together. Sitting apart was a slightly built, smiling African in cotton singlet and drawers. This was the newly hired linguista, Simmons told him, a protégé of Tucker's. Simmons did not look well, he noticed. The mate's eyes were heavy-lidded, and he held his head as if movement gave him pain there. Thurso came down to the landing stage with the dignified and gravely smiling Tucker by his side. After they had exchanged civilities and assurances of further trade, the yawl was cast off. The wind was up, and there was a heavy sea over the river mouth, obliging them to make a wide tack westward, so as to get more easily over the bar. Back on board they found the carpenter, with four men to assist him, busy constructing a barricade of stakes across the forepart of the quarter-deck, lashing the upright stanchions to long horizontals of inch-thick board that extended from side to side, with gates above the companion ladders. The starboard side was already complete. Johnson and Libby had run the swivel cannon out of its port, so as to turn the muzzle through the fence, down onto the slave deck below. The captain had scarcely set foot on deck when Haynes came to him with a complaint against one of the negroes. Bullies need not be cowards, and in fact Haynes wasn't one, but hireling bullies need the countenance of their chiefs, and the boatswain had been more than usually officious since his disgrace in an attempt to recover lost ground.
"Morgan reported it to me, sir," Paris heard him say. "I checked it myself this morning and found it to be true."
Thurso, with the boatswain at his side, took some steps away, and Paris did not catch the rest of what was said. Haynes had strange eyes, he thought. There was a constant glitter in them that seemed nothing to do with his mood or feelings. The surgeon felt tired after the broken sleep of the night before, and at the same time curiously heartsick, as if at some loss or shock whose nature he could not precisely determine.
"Fetch the man aft," he heard Thurso say with a sudden hoarse ferocity, "and bring the linguister!"
Standing against the rail, Paris watched one of the slaves unshackled from his fellow by Kavanagh and Sullivan and led towards them. He was a tall man, loose-limbed and rather shambling in gait, though Paris thought this might be due to weakness. His face was broad and heavy-boned, the eyes deep-set below the ridges of the brows. He was emaciated. The lines of rib-cage and breastbone were clearly visible below the skin. The inflamed K of his brand mark lay high on the left side of his chest, above the heart.
"It seems it has been going on for some days past, sir," Haynes said. "But that fool Morgan did not see fit to say nothing, nor Wilson and Blair, that has had the job of serving them their beans and yams. Has Morgan anything ready now?"
"He is cooking a slave's rice, sir."
"So I'll fetch some."
Thurso turned to the negro, who stood with head downcast.
"Now, you dog," he said. "You've been setting a bad example, have you? I'll teach you tricks."
He glared round irately.
"Where the devil is the linguister?"
"Standing by, Captain, sir."
He had been at Thurso's side all the while, but he was so short in stature that the captain had overlooked him.
"Jimmy is here," he said.
His smile was amazing, occupying the whole of his face, all but closing his eyes, exposing a row of pale gums.
"This Wolof man," he said. "Bad temper, people. I don't speak Wolof. Try him Bambara linga."
"Tell him," Thurso said, "that he is going to be given some rice, and if he doesn't eat it, I'll set him down below in the dark with the screws on him."
"Screws?"
Jimmy's smile diminished at this difficulty.
"Thumb screws, you fool."
Thurso's temper was deteriorating. He made a gesture of turning a key against his thumb.
"Understand perfect."
Jimmy spoke for some moments in a language of soft, rising inflections. The slave continued to hang his head, making no reply, nor showing any sign that he was aware of being addressed. The rice was brought from the galley by a flustered Morgan, plump and aproned and sweating copiously as usual. It was thrust under the nose of the slave, who turned his head mutely from it. Thurso's precarious hold on his temper was not proof against this defiance. He struck the man heavily on the side of his lowered head, sending him to the deck, where he lay motionless, but with his eyes open still. Thurzo stood for some moments looking down at him. Then, in his hoarse and grating voice, which showed small variety of tone, whatever his feelings, he said,
"Take him below, Haynes. Put the screws on him. Both thumbs. Leave him in the dark on his own. We'll try him again later and see if he's come to better sense."
Without waiting to see the man hauled to his feet, Paris turned away abruptly. He had taken some steps towards the ladderway when Thurzo's voice recalled him. He turned and stood facing the captain at some pace's distance.
"Mr. Paris," Thurzo said, "it is customary for the members of a ship's company, including the officers, to take their cue from the captain. You do not withdraw yourself without a word. You will remain here until you get leave to go, sir."
Paris felt the blood rush to his face at this public rebuke. He was aware of the people looking on, the negro still sprawled on the deck, the grouped slaves behind him in the waist. All seemed to be waiting, to be expecting something from him. He paused to control his breathing. When he spoke, it was in a voice deeper than usual.
"Sir, I know I'm subject to your orders, as are all on board, but I am a doctor, and I take my profession seriously. I suppose I'm here for all on the ship. I cannot easily see that crushing his thumbs is the best way to make him eat. It might be possible to try persuasion."
"Persuasion?" The word came, hoarse and lingering, charged with contempt. Barton, at some paces off, uttered a suppressed sniggering, and grins spread among the crew. Thurzo's tactical sense was formidable, and he exploited it now.
"Persuasion?" he said again, and made a stiff gesture of incredulity.
It was to occur later to Paris that by using this word he had saved himself from some more violent expression of the captain's antipathy. Thurzo's temper was at a dangerous pitch, and the law supported his authority. But there was no need now to assert this further. In the eyes of the men looking on, all conditioned to violence, the surgeon had shown weakness, not of character, but in his grasp of reality. Condescension served Thurzo better now. He knew it, and the knowledge went some way to restoring his temper.
"We have 36 slaves already aboard, Mr. Paris. When we leave this coast, we shall have a cargo, God willing, of more than 200, and a crew possibly of 25. And you talk of persuasion. I thought you had more sense."
Paris found nothing to say in response to this. He did not mind losing ground with the crew, if indeed he had done so. He had no wish to be a spokesman for them, or any kind of leader. Never again to take up a voice for others had been one of the first vows he had made in the ruins of his life. He remained there while the recalcitrant slave was taken below. Thurzo repeated his orders for the thumbscrews, adding a caution of
"not too sharp"
to the boatswain. This done, he surprised the surgeon with a request to accompany him to his cabin.
"Have a seat, sir," he said. "You'll take a glass of port?"
"Thank you." Paris watched the captain take out decanter and glasses from the locker above his table. A certain feeling of wariness came to him. Thurzo was predictable only in his determination to secure good profits. Otherwise, in the motions of his spirit, he unsettled expectation in the way that persons did who could not be accounted wholly sane.
"Your health, sir."
Thurzo looked with concealed dislike at the man before him, taking in yet again the details of the surgeon's appearance, the awkward frame, the ravaged look of the face, the pale eyes that did not retreat before his own. It seemed an inventory he had been condemned through eternity to go on making. He wondered how he had transgressed against his demon to be visited with this plaguey fellow on his last voyage, wondered why it should matter, with himself and Barton so soon to do their private trade. The gold dust they would get for the muskets, and his share of the profits on the voyage, together with what he had already, would see him through comfortably. But he was accustomed to think of his career as a monument to fidelity and good profits and satisfaction to his owners, and this was his present owner's nephew, and also a half-baked fellow who might carry tales back, garble things, cast reflections on a man's reputation. But a deeper reason underlay these, one that even now he was unwilling to acknowledge fully to himself. There was a quality in the surgeon he recognized as dangerous. Thurzo understood the nature of power, as he did that of the sea, by instinct and experience. He had felt the force of the surgeon's intervention just now. Paris had obliged him to play to the gallery, something he did rarely.
"I will overlook your words and manners just now," he said, "on the ground that you are ignorant of the usages of the sea. This ship, and all aboard her, are in my hands. No one quits the captain's presence without a form of asking permission, whether he be the doctor or the cabin boy. I will request you to remember that in future. And no one makes remarks in any way reflecting on the captain's judgment. I will request you to remember that, too. Now, as to the slave who refuses food, he does it out of a perverse desire to frustrate us and make himself awkward. There is a wicked, contrary spirit in these people, Mr. Paris. I know him well. If they would make the best of their condition, a slave ship could be a happy ship. But our lot is made harder by their sly and sullen ways. And mark you this, such a thing will spread to the others if they see it spoils our game to any degree. They are watching us all the time, without seeming to. One man starts refusing food, and before you know where you are, they will all be doing it. Most of them find their appetites again soon enough after a whipping, but there will be those that take longer, and if they weaken themselves now, they are more than likely to die on the passage to the West Indies. And remember, for every slave that dies on board ship, we lose the price we might have raised at Kingston Market, which presently stands at £50 cash for a prime male slave."
Here, in this narrow space, the captain's voice had declined to a hoarse mutter, little more than a whisper. He sat back now to drink some of his port, then set the glass down carefully, looking closely at the surgeon from the square cage of his brows.
£50, Mr. Paris. That is money. A man can live a year in England on £50 and not go short of much. And it is a dead loss if they die of sickness or any natural cause. The insurers will not pay except they die in the course of an uprising or insurrection, and even then to scarce half the value. No, sir. We must strive to preserve them. A man who can't see that is a fool, and there's an end of it.
It had been a long speech for Thurzo, and his face had flushed darker with the vehemence of it. Perhaps, too, Paris thought, with resentment at being thus driven to explanations. Why he felt so driven was not clear to the surgeon at present, though he saw clearly enough that Thurzo had reduced the world to a dominant principle and wrenched his moral frame to accommodate it. By some odd quirk of spirit, he found himself fancying that Thurzo's occasional stiff gestures were a physical sign of this wrenching process. Meanwhile, he was at some loss as to how to reply. Silence would be safer, more politic. He was aware that the captain had made a bid for his understanding, perhaps even for his sympathy. But Paris found himself unable to remain silent. In abjuring argument, he had forgotten how bitter it can be to leave an adversary in possession of the field. Even while he thus hesitated, he saw the captain's eyes narrow and the hand on the table slowly clench.
"I can speak my mind to you, I suppose," he said at last,
with that air of earnest pertinency that Thurzo had found odious from their first acquaintance, "since you have done so with me, and in any case there are none to hear us.
I saw that man's face, sir. I particularly observed his looks. He is not refusing food in order to spite us or inconvenience us, but because he is set on dying." "Are you such a fool that you cannot see that it is the same thing?"
"The same thing?
How the same thing?"
He looked in astonishment at the captain's face, saw the square jaws clench with a fury almost convulsive. It seemed that his question was by way of being the last straw for Thurzo, who now leaned forward and spoke with an unconcealed violence of antipathy.
"I see it now. You are one of those radical fellows they speak of who will accept no authority. You will question everything. You will always think you know better. Hark to me now. The black will be tried with food again in the morning. If he refuses to eat, I will set Haynes to flog him before them all until the skin hangs off him, and I will continue so until he consents to eat or dies. That has been my practice before, and it shall be the same now."
Pausing, He found the surgeon's eyes on him, intent, without fear, hatefully perceptive. The other man's presence was strong, oppressive to him, exerting some constraint that poisoned his fury with a sense of impotence, obliging him to explain, to seek to convert, to look for comprehension. He felt the blood beating heavily at his temples.
"You preachy fool! You should have been a parson," he said. "He cannot be allowed to die as he chooses. They must not believe they have the disposal of themselves. If you don't understand that, you understand nothing. If he is going to die, it must be at our hands, and in pain, so that the others will not be corrupted."
Paris rose to his feet. He felt himself quivering internally with the offence of Thurso's words and the reciprocal violence the other's antagonism aroused in him. He thrust his hands behind his back.
"I understand your words, sir," he said huskily. "With your permission, I shall now..."
At this moment, while the two were looking fixedly at each other, there came a cry from deck of a craft sighted. Thurso at once seized his hat, and without a further word or glance, stumped out of the cabin, the surgeon following. They stood on deck, watching the approach of a narrow dugout with a framework amidships, covered with palm thatch.
"That is a riverboat, Mr. Barton,"
Thurso said in his usual tones.
"Aye, sir."
The captain raised his telescope.
"They look like Susu people to me," he said. "They've got someone there under the awning."
"It is a white man," he added after some moments. It was not until the dugout was considerably nearer, and riding broadside onto them, that they were able to see that the man in the shadow of the thatch was Cali, wearing only a pair of filthy cotton drawers, with his arms bound behind him.
"So," Thurso said grimly, "one of our birds has come home to roost. These are up-country people. We shall need the linguister."
"Standing by, sir, Captain."
"What the devil is funny?"
"Nothing funny, Captain. Some of these men maybe speak Malinke."
"Tell them they're welcome aboard," Thurso said. "Tell them they can come up."
Jimmy shouted down to the men in the boat below in a language of high, wavering pitch changes. He listened to the grave reply.
"They say they're not coming up, sir."
"Why in perdition not?"
"They say they don't like come up on the ship. They perlite people. Don't like to say it. My opinion they scared of being panyard for slaves."
"They can trust me. I'm known up and down this coast. I wouldn't carry off free Africans. I give them dashi, one demijohn brandy. Tell them I'm pleased they catch this runaway buckraman."
He looked balefully down at the unfortunate Cali, who sat in the shade of the palm thatch, head down, a picture of dejection. His upper arms were drawn together behind him with twisted raffia, so tightly that his neck tendons and the powerful muscles at his shoulders were tense with his efforts to withstand the traction. Jimmy translated, rubbing his chest in a circular fashion and half extending his right arm towards the boatman to indicate Thurso's deep and abiding pleasure at the capture.
"They say they trust you, and they believe you." "Good. They're sensible fellows."
Thurso looked down approvingly.
"Why aren't they moving?" he said impatiently after a moment. "They're not coming up, sir. They say they believe you now, but you may change mind while they're on the way up, and you cannot guarantee that you will not change mind, as nobody can guarantee future thinking of his mind."
In relief at having got through to the end of this difficult sentence, Jimmy forgot himself again and smiled broadly.
"So they're not coming up," he said. "That's the top and tail of it."
"By God," Thurso said savagely, "that man shall suffer for this when I get my hands on him. If we had been homeward bound with the slaves discharged, I would have let them rot ashore. Tell them the brandy will be lowered down to them. All they have to do is to loose his bonds in a way that will allow him to mount the accommodation ladder."
Jimmy spoke again, and the man in the prow of the dugout replied in a long and statesmanlike speech marked by grave, emphatic gesture.
"Begging your pardon, Captain,"
Haynes said, still seeking favour and reinstatement.
"Why don't we shoot one of the beggars? That one gabbling now. We could pick him off easily. That would bring him round."
He paused a moment, clearly taken with the beautiful simplicity of his idea.
"Why not shoot them all?" he said. "You blockhead," Thurso said, turning upon him sharply. "Risk rousing the coast against us? Who would come trading the ship after that?" "They're not satisfied with the offer,"
Jimmy announced.
"Very well, I can give them tobacco if they prefer." "No, sir, pardon me."
In pure nervousness now, Jimmy smiled again.
"They want brandy and tobacco, he said. That is dashi for catch him. They say they want also 10 baht slave price. What?
Thurso's brows drew together. For some moments it looked as if he might burst into some violent expression of rage, but then a different look came to his face, something resigned, humorous almost. He glanced aside and nodded to himself as if in recognition.
Aye, he muttered, but they are traitors, these people. They sit there under our guns and hold us to ransom. They separate the merit of the capture from the man's price and make us pay for both. Tell them, I agree, but I won't haggle over the bars. They can have 10 head blue beads for him. Take or leave it, and tell them he is not a slave, but an English seaman.
The offer was signalled satisfactory by the men below, who were more interested, for the moment at least, in beads and brandy than in definitions. The goods were lowered down over the side. Callie was untied and hoisted onto the ladder to make his slow way upward with cramped arms. The dugout, cast free of the ship, made speed shoreward, the 4 men throwing themselves on the oars for dear life. Callie was seized by Johnson and Haynes before his feet had touched the deck. He made no resistance. Exhaustion, the sense of being a wrongdoer, the knowledge of punishment to come, combined to take the fight out of him. He was parched with thirst and bleeding from a host of scratches and cuts. He was given shirt and breeches from the ship's store. Then he was placed in leg irons and set on the forward part of the main deck under the eye of the first mate, whose watch it was. The end of the afternoon watch, with most of the ship's work done for the day and nearly everyone on deck, was the time favoured by Thurso for the carrying out of exemplary punishments. It was then that Wilson had been flogged, and Thomas True, and Evans, and it was then that the time came for Callie. He did not plead, but he whimpered while he was being tied, and began to cry out terribly with the first blows. When taken down, he was conscious still, and uttering sounds in his throat, curiously as if trying to reassure himself. However, he was not able to get to his feet without help, or stand unsupported. Paris, who had battled to establish his right to ministration in the earlier cases, felt he needed no further permission now. With Blair, distressed and blasphemous to help him, he got Callie to the sick bay, got the heavy, helpless body facing down on the bunk, and began to do what he could to clean the mess of blood from the back and staunch the lacerations. Under the spread of water, blood frilled like petals from the wounds the knots of the cat had made from nape to waist, and stirred the torn skin at the edges of the lash marks. Callie, so abjectly clamorous throughout the public ordeal of his punishment, behaved with fortitude now, helped by a constitution of phenomenal recuperative power. He kept his face pressed into the blanket. After a while, sounds came from him, faltering and half-choked.
"He's trying to say something," Blair said.
The surgeon had asked him to remain, and he stood there now with a basin for the blood-sodden swabs that Paris passed to him.
"He'd better keep mum, hadn't he?"
he said anxiously. Paris glanced at him a moment. Blair's face had paled, the freckles showed over the bridge of his nose, and his eyes looked unnaturally prominent. He had looked thus at the branding of the first slaves, the surgeon recalled suddenly. Not a callous man at all, Blair, he thought, bluster and bravado apart. Tender-hearted, even, whenever he couldn't find a cause for rage to save him from it.
No reason why he shouldn't talk if he wants, he said mildly. Can you make out what he is saying? The man is strong as an ox.
Saying this, he remembered the only other time Callie had spoken to him.
He gets a saddle to put on,
and the look of shy mirth that had accompanied it. His friend and protector standing beside him.
"What you saying, shipmate?"
Blair said, leaning down and talking loudly as if to a deaf man.
"You aren't very bright,"
he said confidentially to Paris. Callie kept his face pressed to the blanket.
"Deacon gone?"
he mumbled, forming the sounds from the red mist his consciousness was reduced to.
"I didn't go with him."
All the events of these last days, already scrambled hopelessly in his mind, turned on this central desolation. Blundering lost,
through the endless savannah, panicking at silence, tormented by thirst, struck and baited by the tribesmen when they had finally succeeded in subduing him, vengeance this for the several that had been hurt in the process, none of it was more than a nightmare embroidery surrounding his desertion of Deacon. The words continued to issue from him.
"I came back. Those noises. I was scared. Deacon gone by himself now. He shouted for Dan'l, shouted for me."
The two men listening had not understood everything of this because Callie's face was muffled and the pain of the flogging choked the sounds in his throat. But after some moments they understood that the nature of the sounds had changed. They had become broken and gasping.
"Dinna be snuffling, lad," Blair said.
And to him, too, there came a memory, waking in the darkness of the hulk to pain and the sound of rats and weeping.
"No use snuffling," he said.
Hearing something in the other's voice, Paris glanced at him quickly and then away. Blair had tears in his eyes. The surgeon felt a sympathetic prickling behind his own. Oblivious to the words and feelings of those above him and to the touch of water on his back, Callie wept into the blanket for the betrayal of his friend. When Deacon became aware of the silence, and turned and called Callie's name and received no reply, he knew at once that the other was not far away, that he was crouching somewhere among the bushes, hiding. The world became very quiet to Deacon at this moment, so quiet that he thought he would be able to hear the pulse of Callie's fear if he listened closely enough. But he did not want to find Callie now.
"Go back, Dan'l," he called. "Make back to the river and follow downstream."
The sound disturbed birds somewhere high above him. He heard the volley of their wings. No other answer came. He waited some while longer, then went on. For a time he listened, but he knew that Callie would not come after him now. The silence persisted, enveloping him, absorbing the sounds of his passage. He tried at first to keep north, following the course of the river, but the ground was swampy and treacherous, and he stumbled among the intricate mangrove roots. He found himself longing for the open. All his passion for flight was in open country. He needed the complicity of the sky. In the evening, he turned westward into more thinly wooded ground that rose slowly from the river, interspersed with belts of shrub. Here the going was easier, and he made some miles before nightfall. He drank water from the tin container that, together with a pistol, he wore at his belt. It was more than half empty now. He ate some of the ship's bread and salt pork he had kept wrapped all day inside his shirt. The bread was damp with his sweat. Late in the afternoon of the following day, he drank the last of his water. He was now in a country of broken woodland and spreads of tall, tussocky grass. The sky was open above him. Faint shadows of hawks moved over the ground. The silence intensified, and within it Deacon spoke to himself, sometimes aloud. He would come to a village. People would come out from their houses. He would establish a trading post. Palm wine, lime juice, coconut milk. "Don't sleep. They will sell you." He could trade in gold dust, parrot's feathers, teak. He did not believe it. He could not imagine the shape of the houses in the village, or the look of the people. And with this failure there came the knowledge that all his plans of trading had been only pretexts to find himself here, on the move, in this empty country. Food he forgot in the growing torment of thirst. His own voice spoke no longer, but his father questioned him, cane in hand.
"Where are you making for? You know what will happen when you reach Jamaica, don't you? What will they do to you when they get you on a Navy ship again?"
There was no way of answering, so as to avoid error. No possible answer could avert his father's rage. Whatever he said, he would be beaten and locked up in the dark shed. "Thurso gets the bounty," he said, trying to evade punishment by answering a different question altogether. "Thurso gets 5 guineas for me." But this was wrong. His father's face grew dark and swollen. It filled the sky and burst, and Deacon drank what rain he could catch in his mouth and his cupped hands. That was on the fourth day of his freedom. After the rain, the long, tawny grasses were swept by whispers. The sun came out again, and the ground steamed.
His pace was slow now, and he staggered a little, but he was cooled by the rain, and his mind was clear. He had no sense of a destination. It came to him that he had never had one. All his destinations had been only breaking loose. But that was not it either. Patiently, like a celibate, remembering some cherished episode of love, he began to assemble the details of that first escape, the feel of the metal bar in the dark, the fear and exultation of the splintering wood. No tropical light had ever been so blinding as that of the dim dawn he had stepped into then. No sky at sea so vast as that one. That light, that enlargement, had been destination enough. He had never found it again. He had run ever since between narrowing walls under lowering skies. He slept in his damp clothes and woke feverish. At first light he was on the move again, but his progress now was very slow. He was beginning to lose his sense of the rhythm of his walking, stepping too short, not raising his feet enough, so that he frequently stumbled and sometimes fell. With each fall, the recovery took longer. Soon after sunrise, crossing a wide savannah, with the grass heads glinting reddish and the low, broad-leaved trees beaded with fire, Deacon saw figures moving like dark flames to encircle him. One pointed or gestured with a strange, repeated jabbing motion, and the sun ran in glitters on something. They were round him, in a circle. That is how you capture a man or a beast, Deacon knew, one that you think might be dangerous. To be enclosed on all sides is the end of a runner. Frighten them off. Again, the gleam of the raised spears caught his eyes. They would want his pistol and his water bottle and his leather belt. They would want to tie him. His sight was confused. He fumbled the pistol out of his belt and fired at a flash of sunlight. The sound was shattering. It was inconceivable that any sound could ever follow it, and for Deacon, none did. He saw another flash, different, speedy, but he heard nothing. The spear struck him below the breastbone and pierced him almost through. He fell to his knees and rested there a moment, holding the shaft like something precious, and the destination of light briefly flooded his eyes from a sky that blazed and closed. Chapter 29. No one on board ever knew what had become of Deacon. He joined the company of those who have no official death. For the Admiralty, he remained a deserter in perpetuity. On Thurso's crew list, he was entered as Run, and this was all his epitaph. Paris, writing in his journal at intervals that grew longer, gave him space only for good wishes. By this time, for the surgeon, Deacon's disappearance had been overshadowed by a death that was official. Jack Simmons, our second mate, is no longer with us. He departed this life yesterday. I had noticed on our return from Tucker's that he bore every appearance of fever. The day following he was sent out again, and on return of the yawl was unable to get aboard without assistance, and complained much of headache and a weakness in his limbs. That evening, the fever mounting, I had him conveyed to the sick room and attempted to allay the heat by bathing of his limbs and administering an infusion of powdered cinchona bark, of which I came provided with a good stock. But the fever grew worse in the night. I've seldom seen such violent throes. They came close to paroxysm. Early next morning he began to exude small quantities of blood from his nose and gums and the corners of his eyes. I detected marks of blood also on his forehead and in his armpits. Within 2 hours of this discharge, the heat subsided abruptly. A clammy moisture succeeded, and the poor fellow's face took on the look of death. He asked me to make sure that his wife received the wages due to him, and I promised to do so. I had not known he was married. At 3 in the afternoon he began to vomit quantities of blood darkened with bile, and shortly after choked and so died, I standing by quite powerless to save him, or even much to alleviate his sufferings. His body was committed to the sea the same evening, with Thurso reading the service. I am persuaded that this is a case of the black vomit, as the disease is called,
which often afflicts our soldiers, as I have read, on their tours of foreign duty. It is very possible, I think probable, that Simmons caught the contagion that very evening we separated, I to remain with Owen, he to return to his shipmates at Tucker's. He would have drunk heavily there, and perhaps lain with a native woman somewhere out in the open, and slept thus, amidst the impure effluvia of air proceeding from that marshy ground, acted upon all day by solar heat, and at night, releasing its poisons. Paris paused for some moments, pen in hand. He was thinking of his actions from the moment he had noted the violence of Simmons' fever. He had gone to his cabin and quite deliberately eaten a certain quantity of bread dipped in vinegar. One should never attend the sick when the stomach is empty, the body being then at its most absorbent. He had looked at his face in the small looking-glass fixed to the locker, the deeply marked forehead, the lines that ran from the nostrils to the corners of the mouth, the pale eyes under thick brows that slanted downward with a slightly dog-like effect, at once mournful and alert. A face not unhandsome, though roughly made and too bony. The face, he knew it then, of a man who did not want to die, who was bolting these sops of bread in fear of death. He clung to the world still, for all his shame and loss and grief. He had stopped his nostrils before returning to Simmons, with lint dipped in the same vinegar, and after the man's death he had washed out his mouth with camphorated spirits. To be of service on the ship, yes, but he knew that was secondary. What he remembered now was the bread dissolving in his mouth, all hope of life in that sour taste, thinking of it here in the close, confessional privacy of his cabin, he felt a traitor. But to whom, or what, he did not know. The number of slaves continues steadily to augment. Tucker, in accordance with his promise, has furnished a batch of 22 males and 8 females, all captured by his people in the wars he has been fomenting inland. One of his sons was killed in the raid, which had the effect of making Tucker very oppressive and implacable when it came to the bargaining. He asked 70 bars for the adult males, and pushed the equivalent in trade goods to levels that brought Thurso close to apoplexy, though one might have thought this exorbitance would compel our captain's respect, it being, after all, the mark of a true trader to compensate himself for loss. "Fortunate for us, he lost only one of his sons," Barton remarked to me with that peering, foxy look of his, "or he would have cleaned us out of printed cottons altogether." The mulatto's prices had to be met in any case, as he controls much of the trade on the river, and I believe the supply of slaves can be much curtailed by his disfavour. What can happen to those who get in his way, I saw some evidence of in Owen's shed. The slaves are still kept on deck, except in squally weather, but there are more than 70 now, and they will have to be accommodated below when we are at sea. To this end, Barber is installing platforms between the decks. There can be no doubt that a carpenter on a slave ship earns his wages. Barber has had to see to the trimming and raising of the hatches, the construction of the barricade, and now these divisions in the hold, which has meant fitting platforms and partitions to divide the space below the deck into separate lodging rooms for the men, the boys, and the women. As there is no more than 5 feet of vertical space in the hold to begin with, and these platforms will halve it, it is difficult to see how the negroes will have room even to sit upright. Thurso, made anxious by symptoms of melancholy and lethargy among the captives, has instituted a joyless ceremony known as dancing the slaves, which Barton tells me is an old practice among slavers. After the morning meal, Sullivan is brought out to play reels on his fiddle, while the women, who are not shackled, dance about the deck, and the men jump in their irons as best they can, though it is a torture to men with swollen limbs. Thurso is too absolute in his habit of mind to grant any exemptions, and so they are forced to continue till their ankles are raw and bleeding, the sailors keeping them to it with whips. There are those among the crew, the more brutish, who visibly enjoy this exercise. I've seen Libby and Tapley and Wilson grin to do it and laugh at the sad antics that they oblige the Negroes to perform. They're made to sing also, and sometimes they independently set up a wavering song among themselves. Jimmy, our linguista, tells me that these songs are full of sorrow, as one might expect, that their slow movements and this sad singing are at ludicrous odds with the brisk tempo of his fiddling seems not to trouble Sullivan at all. It is clear that he loves his fiddle, and he plays it here with the same spirit as I have no doubt he would at a country wedding in Ireland. I spent some time in talking to Jimmy, who is very friendly and open, sensitive too, I believe. He conceals a good deal under that smile of his, which is due more to an inveterate habit of the nerves, I think, than to any real amusement. It is his ambition to be a teacher with a school for local children here on the coast at Cape Palmas, under the protection of the English garrison there. He hopes to accompany us back to England and find an employment that would allow him to improve his knowledge of English. If Jimmy feels that he is betraying his enslaved fellows by thus acting as intermediary with their captors, he gives no sign of it. Perhaps he does not feel that they are his fellows at all. Because they have all black faces, we suppose them close in fellowship. But when have we been so towards people only because they are white-skinned like ourselves? I have not noticed much affection and loyalty among us towards the Dutch or the French. Jimmy does not know how old he is. I should say about 30. He is of the Hausa people, he has told me, and was brought to the coast as a child when his parents were enslaved by the Ashanti. The captives themselves are not united. I have seen a good deal of squabbling and bad feeling among them. Yesterday, not long after Simmons' death, I saw one throw his rice in the face of another. They are of different races and tongues, and reach the ship by diverse routes. This, too, I have learned from our linguista. Some are prisoners of war, others have been domestic slaves already, and are sold now by their masters to pay off debts or provide wedding portions. Yet others have been seized by local slavers such as the late Yellow Henry. But however varied the routes by which these unfortunates reach the deck of the Liverpool Merchant, once here they are brought to a uniform condition with remarkable... He was interrupted by Charlie, who came knocking at his door to tell him that one of the Negroes was thought to be dying.
"The one that won't take his grub, sir,"
Charlie said, his starveling face full of wonder. Up on deck, however, there was no opportunity to see the man alone. The captain had been informed and was standing in colloquy with Haynes on the quarter-deck at the head of the companion ladder. As always, because of Thurzo's stillness and the unchanging pitch of his voice, his feelings were not at first apparent. But as Paris drew closer, he saw the furious look of the captain's eyes and the rigid set of his jaws, and he felt a curious weakness, as if brought cold and reluctant to some passage of arms.
"I'll see he eats," Thurzo said. "He will sup before he dies. Lay forward there for the wrench and the funnel, Haynes."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"The wrench." Paris did not know what was meant. He had seen, like a premonition, a certain kind of satisfaction pass over Haynes's face.
"I want the man brought aft, below me here." Thurzo turned to the surgeon.
"Yes, sir,"
he said.
"You shall see this malingering fella eat his rice at last."
The Negro came supported between two men, his head hanging. Paris, looking down from the quarter-deck, saw the marks of the lash across his shoulders, saw the red mess of his thumbs, saw at the same moment what Haynes was carrying, took it at first for a large pair of dividers, then recognised the notched prongs and the broad wing screw.
"But that is the speculum oris," he said,
and saw the faintly sneering look of knowledge of him, or expectation of some pretext for derision, rise in the boatswain's face.
"Aye, is it, doctor?"
he said.
"We calls it a gob-wrench."
"But you'll spoil his mouth,"
Paris said, and watched the sneer deepen on the boatswain's face. He had seen the instrument used to force open the mouths of patients suffering from lockjaw, and he knew the damage it could inflict if clumsily applied, the broken teeth and torn gums.
"You will reduce his value,"
he said, in an attempt to impress Thurzo with a commercial argument, a ludicrously inept one, he knew. The man was near death in any case.
"Let me try him with food," he said. "With your permission, sir, I will make an attempt with him."
You are for persuasion still, I see.
Thurzo paused for what seemed some private reflection.
Very well, he said at last. I will allow you a few minutes. I care not how he comes to it, so long as he does so and is seen to, but you're wasting your time.
Paris descended from the gangway to the main deck. The two men supporting the negro, Tapley and McGann, finding him a dead weight, had set him down against the base of the gangway ladder. The surgeon crouched in an attempt to look into the man's face.
What shall we try him with, sir?
This was an offer Paris turned sharply towards, a voice that held something for him. Glancing up, he saw that it belonged to Hughes, the misanthropic climber, who had not addressed a syllable to him ever before. Hughes was regarding him with a sombre intentness, not unfriendly.
Wild rice, I think, as before.